You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The future of a men's state prison in South Dakota is coming into focus. A task force is recommending a new 1,500-bed facility on the north side of Sioux Falls with a price cap of $650 million. Governor Larry Brodin has called a special legislative session for September 25th. The goal is passing legislation that gives the Department of Corrections a path forward to building the new prison. Also, the State Appropriations Committee meets today. On the original agenda, but later struck, a conversation about, quote, zero-based budgeting. SDPB is here to help you understand how your government works, even when the mechanics are complex. For today's Dakota Political Junkies conversation, we welcome Jean Hunhoff and Linda Duba. Former Senator Hunhoff is the longest-serving female member of the South Dakota legislature at 24 years. Linda Duba is a former state representative. Both women served on the Joint Appropriations Committee.
When you're in appropriations, you have to have a wider lens. Yeah. People say there's a party lens, but you have to really look at something from impact. You know, impact and outcome. And if you're trying to understand impact and outcome, the importance is to use the data that's been presented to you to get the biggest bang for your buck. And that may not be it may be part of a party's ideology, but essentially what it's saying is this is what's best for the state, for the people of South Dakota.
Yeah. Senator Hunhoff, that's where you get to where you often say, I need the data. I need the information.
Absolutely. And I think, appropriations, yes, it is a process, but it's also a compromise process. Mm-hmm. And it's to get to that compromise as to what that vision is or what the priorities are. And that's where the debate becomes then and sort of becomes party line as to where what we should be doing with the taxpayer dollars to prioritize. You know, I can only speak from when we were in the legislature, and that was part of it. The two parties would establish their priorities. They'd come together, and we'd have some early on discussions to know, okay, what are the things we're on the same page for so we don't have to spend time on that? Where are the differences, and how do we bring those differences closer together that we are meeting those needs? And I think that's the piece that I always looked at, and to me it was the data that drives that, so that as Linda said, you've got to have a bigger vision out there, and you've got to look at what are we trying to achieve, and then what do we have to show that we achieved it or did not achieve it? Mm-hmm. Because, again, if we're using taxpayer dollars, there needs to be a definite outcome for those dollars, and we need to see the results.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about the Project Prison Reset. We have a date for a special session. We have a new plan. What are some of the things that you're noticing about the new plan? Representative Duba, you want to start there?
Well, I listened to or attended each one of those meetings, mostly listened to, and then I showed up on the last day. What I found interesting, and I've said this in the past, is we've had two major studies now conducted. Mm-hmm. Both of them came back with the same results. We need to build a 1,500-person facility. It needs to be close to Sioux Falls. It needs to have all of these functions and... You know, we need to have education and retraining and rehabilitation, and let's do this the right way. And then in comes a group, and we worked very hard for 3 years. And I will credit Jean Hunhoff sitting next to me, who established that prison task force fund, that trust fund. We put our monies in there so that we could save. We've saved significant amount of funding, and yet the task force comes back, puts a cap on it, and says no more than this, and all the studies point to it's probably going to cost us this much. Now, the other thing that frustrated me is that we are going to lose about $40 million out of the money that we invested in the Lincoln County site. So I want all of South Dakota to understand that money is now throwaway, not to mention the amount of money that we're paying out for this task force to take place, for all the work we've had to do to support it, the additional studies, and the amount of time that we are going to lose as a result of waiting, waiting, waiting. In the end, the group passed a bill that said we're going to spend $650, even though the experts said it's going to cost $725.
Passed a recommendation. Sent that recommendation up to the governor, yeah.
So data is what should drive our decisions, not emotion, but real data. We presented real data. We did all of the things that we needed to do. And I'm concerned. And also, the other thing that people don't understand is we do not have to write a check for $650 million on the very first day that we put a shovel in the ground. So we can fund this, but understand that by putting this cap on there, we may have to do some reductions in areas that we choose not to.
Jean Hunhoff, what would you add to that, and are you concerned?
Well, I'm concerned that we get a product at the end of the day. We need a prison. That's what we need. And unfortunately, in the dialogue, all these other byproducts kept coming in there and playing in. And so the focus, not till the very end, and then this decision as to what the bed size would be, and that was the original. I guess a couple things come in mind. First of all, I did not attend, and I listened to some, but I didn't. But at the end of the day, apparently this last location that is being identified as a potential really is, if the consultants came back in, they would indicate this is the number one choice. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because the utilities are already in the ground, and that saves us about $18 million.
That's true.
So we've got that point. It's only a mile away from the standing. Again, I was trying to get some location on that. And I think the other point is that, you know, along this process, everybody chipped in to that bill that we established the prison construction fund. That was visionary to say, we don't want to take it out of general. We want to pay up front. We want to make sure we're able to do that. And we were able to get, I believe there's a little over under $600 million in that fund now. Mm-hmm. And this year, then Representative Van Huysen introduced a bill that said all the interest on those dollars would go to that fund so that they wouldn't go back to the general fund. And I believe on July 1st, I heard there's about $24 million that went into that. Okay. So let's say $624 million and plus there's some out there. The other thing is we also heard that at the end of the year that our reserves have exceeded more than our expectations. You know, it has been a past in the history that when you looked at the reserves, that the governor would say 10% of your budget should be reserves. And I believe we're closer now to about 20%. So there are additional dollars. And I think the other thing is, if you remember during session, there was just two camps in the legislature, and one was on the prison fund, leftover dollars to supplement, to put more in there that was left. But at the same time, this was coming from the unclaimed property. And there was another camp out there that said, no, we can't. We've got to put that money in a separate that only goes to support if those people come back to claim their dollars. It never got resolved at the session. So those dollars then that were left over flowed into the general, which then falls to the bottom line, which then goes to the reserve funds, which are the 20%. Mm-hmm. So if you took all that into place, there are dollars. Now, again, the conversation is in the kind of design. The beds are there, the 1,500. That's what was decided upon. The question would be, are they telling us then the same spaces that we were looking for all the additional programming and the other sidebar that went on? What are we doing to work with our felons when they get out, rehab, and all that. Mm-hmm. So is there enough there for all of that so that we can develop some really better programs than we're providing, but you need adequate education and space in that facility? So that's the question that's out there. Can that still be achieved with this same number, with a reduced number for the project, the whole project? I don't know that answer.
Yeah. I have a couple things I want to dive into here. One is with the recidivism and juvenile justice, because you were both here when the juvenile justice, the way we do juvenile justice in South Dakota changed drastically. And some of the arguments in other states is that the pipeline, when you put fewer young people in incarceration, that we're not going to need as many beds in a prison because we have taken reasonable steps to keep the age of entry reduced. I don't know if that's true or not. That's just some of the arguments. Mm-hmm. And then we look at the sentencing in South Dakota, which has also been brought up as a challenge, saying like, hey, if you want to have truth in sentencing, which is what it was called, and make sure that people get a full sentence, give judges a little less leeway to make those decisions, all this kind of goes into a big soup of what we're predicting the future. 1,500 beds is still, though, a good number. Why?
Senator Hunhoff said it best. If we do not have the space and the dollars to dedicate to the individuals who will support this programming, 1,500 beds isn't going to be enough. Mm. We know one of the concerns that we had is there was this talk about, well, let's do it at 1,200. We knew then in 3 years or 4 years when this opened, we'd already be overcapacitized. So 15 is the number. And if we don't change some of the ways that we deal with sentencing and programming and dedicate dollars to that, whether it be in juvenile situations or with these prison programs, 1,500 isn't going to be enough. And that second study told us that. Mm. So if we do nothing other than build a facility and not really focus on programming and probation and parole and continue to focus our efforts on juvenile justice and rehabilitation there, 1,500 isn't going to be enough.
You hit on a key about the 1,500 and the number in the sense that you're just talking about programming. You know, during the, again, the dialogue, programming came into there and what we need for rehab. Let's go back 4 or 5 years when the secretary came. She changed behavioral health. It was under the auspices of the Department of Social Services. They contracted with corrections to provide the behavioral health and the facilities or the recovery. Well, when she came, she decided that in her experience, it worked better if they would take those people themselves, that they would be the owners, the employers, rather than contract with DSS, they would now become employees of corrections, and then they'd have more direct role and contact.
You mean Secretary Wasco?
Yes. Yes, okay. Yes. When right. she Thank came. You. So yeah. that change was made. And that was a disruption. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. The people were, you know, mm-hmm. that was a change. They were uncomfortable about that, but I don't know how that has worked out. My concern is, and this is a personal experience, so this summer we've been using day parolees in and paying them for work, for day work. Mm-hmm. doing for us. Sometimes it means that I have to transport them from Yankton to where they're going to go to work and bring them back and do all that. I've had a very unique experience in visiting with about 6 of these individuals that I've had encountered this summer and to really realize what they're going through and the challenges that inside and when they come out. When they come out, they're absolutely, they're on parole, but they're on their own. I mean, I've had to drop someone off before I took him back to his home at the pharmacy so he could pick up his medication. They need time off to get clothes from a clothing closet or whatever. My point is this. It's not just in the prison that we're talking about. I think what they're talking about there is mental health, substance abuse problems, and that. It's when they get out. Mm-hmm. It's going to take more resources out there. These people need transitioning. They need assistance. They need everything. They've been in prison, and now all of a sudden they're walk to the door and say, good luck, goodbye, meet with your parole officer, and life is supposed to go on. So I think there's a bigger picture out there, and that with the 1,500 beds, how does that relate to it? If we're not addressing that and able to meet that, and you still send them out the same way and they don't get that, you're just going to have recidivism come right back, and there's no discussion. The only thing I have heard is that I believe there's been a comment made that the secretary said she's going to have to come back this year to appropriations about money for staffing if we're going to beef these up. And I certainly, there's a way to do that, and we need to do that. But there's a big picture here that I think, again, this prison is just a foundation. It is not the answer to everything. And we've got to make sure we've got a great foundation that we can take care of the people and start a good system there. But it's got to be extended out into the community.
I agree. 110%. We want to integrate these people back into society, and they want to be. But if we aren't going to provide the resources, and when I say that, that means people and programming, which costs money, which then again would come through the state of South Dakota. If we aren't going to dedicate funding to that, then 1,500 beds is not going to be close. And there is a task force this summer that's supposedly addressing this. It takes more than 4 meetings to address this. We need this ongoing. This should be an ongoing focus. Not necessarily, I guess you could call it the legislature, but it should be a focus of the state of South Dakota to figure out how this works. We're more than a building.
The juvenile justice changes that happened with that reform, do we have a sense of outcomes of
yes,
those?
Yes, we do. Now, again, I was on that committee for 5 years, and my last meeting, I think, was in October, November of 2024. But one of the key things that we were looking at over time was programming. Okay, how do we keep these kids out of JDC, out of prison, and what kinds of supports and services are we going to provide for them and their families to move them along the right track? Mm-hmm. You're going to remember this. We had a bill that came to the Appropriations Committee that we passed and the legislature passed. We upped the amount of reimbursement for counties to provide programming, and what we saw was an increase in the number of kids that were serviced, as well as the number of programs that now came online, mm-hmm. because we changed the reimbursement rates for the counties. That made a huge difference to those families. And so we're tracking, we call it recidivism as well. We're tracking whether those kids come back through the system or not.
Senator Hunhoff.
Representative Dubow was more involved with that. I didn't sit on any of those horses, so I just came back. But again, it's like anything else. If you want to be proactive, you've got to start with prevention, and you've got to get that early on. So it's really key in those juvenile diversion programs that we're providing or that we're doing for, that you get those kids then so they don't end up in the pen. But again, it takes resources. And that is always the dilemma over the 5 to 10 years is, do we allocate resources to that? Oh, we can't, you know, there was reluctance. You know, the people were not comfortable in doing that. They knew we needed to do it, but they didn't know how to do it. And that's the other thing. You've got the agencies. They're the experts in the field. They're working. I mean, there's now a reluctance to listen to agencies that, you know, they're not doing their job. Well, I believe they are doing their job. They're trying to work within the parameters we set with them as to what how we fund them. But, you know, I am a lot into prevention and trying to nip this in the bud early on so we're not at the point we're at. And we're not doing that. We're real slow at doing that.
We aren't.
A listener emailed in and was trying to find out if money that was here during COVID got sent back to the federal government, because everybody remembers, you know, Governor Kristi Noem said, no, we don't need this money because maybe it had strings attached or what have you. Was there money that was sent back that could have been used for the prison? Lieutenant Governor Van Huysen said no.
No.
You're both shaking your heads
no.
as well.
No, absolutely okay. none.
The dollars that we could use was the infrastructure dollars that we did send out, and I believe it was... And I'm not going to say it's COVID. After COVID, there was another round of funding that came that you had to be utilized by 26.
ARPA.
It was ARPA. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I believe Lenox, through their water, because they were going to provide some services for the prison, those federal dollars went over there. But to answer your question, no.
And that was $10
Even
million.
Even if we had built it earlier.
Yeah.
If we had moved faster. Still no. Okay.
No, we couldn't.
All right, listener, you can send us back with a more specific question if I didn't get that question right. I want to talk a little bit about, speaking of money coming from the federal government to the state this week, help us understand the kinds of things that are being discussed, including the impact of President Trump's omnibus budget and priority package. What impact is that going to have on the South Dakota budget? We're all looking forward to the next legislative session and wondering, and we're hearing funds for some programs are delayed and then they're opened up again. We're kind of chasing things down, and there's a lot of uncertainty. Secretary of Education, kind of figuring out what kind of education dollars are coming and what aren't. What do you think the impact of the president's bill is going to be?
Ball's in the air, folks. Okay, so when you talk about money being clawed back or then delayed, that's from 2025. So that's in the current congressional budget. So they start a new budget year in October. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the 21st Century Funds, some of that money was just released the other day, $1 billion, I think. And what does that go to? That goes to after-school programming. So out-of-school, after-school programming, and teacher training. That's from the current budget year. That is not this new bill that just got passed.
Right.
So the new bill impacts, I mean, the Medicaid cuts.
The big, beautiful bill.
Yeah.
Impacts, yeah.
The Medicaid cuts are not going to occur until after the midterms. But we front-loaded. So this is really important, I think, that people understand. We front-loaded all the tax cuts, and we could go through each one of those and say, these are permanent, these are not permanent, they're going to expire in XYZ. But all of the tax cuts and much of that takes effect immediately. So now you front load and you bring debt to the government. You increase the deficit. How do we do those? How do we pay for? Those Medicaid cuts are not coming until after. So they'll hit in 2027. And so what you will not see is you won't see the pay downs or the pay fors. The thing that I'm aware of that'll be in that is a couple of things. SNAP benefits are going to be impacted, people who are on food assistance, as well as people who are using subsidies from the government to get health care. I'm not talking about Medicaid now. I'm talking about through exchanges and through Obamacare. So those premiums are going to go up, and everyone's premiums, we're probably going to see increases this year. I could go into other details, but I think essentially what we don't know yet, what we're not seeing yet, is what does it mean when the Department of Education gets eliminated? So a block grant comes to the state. Federal funds come to the state. How are those allocated? Question of the day. We know what the programs are today. Some of those have already been clawed back. But how are those? So we get a block grant and they say, oh, the states know the best way to use it. So what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And are we prepared to do that? And I don't think that we are yet.
And that's where I was going to go too, because I don't know. I mean, I'm just looking at what the media is presenting or what the comments have come out. But we know that there's going to be decline in federal dollars. How much and when is what we don't know. Mm-hmm. And if there's a decline, then the states are going to have to make decisions. Is it still going to be mandated that the state participate in that program, but they pick up a greater share of that? That's my real question that's out there, because if they change any of the guidelines or free it up, you know, how much stays that the state can really make decisions? Use your block grant for education.
Yeah.
Are there going to be the requirements that are out there now as how it is, or are the states going to be the ones to set up their own? And, you know, that depends then who's sitting in the legislature, who's sitting on those boards for each of the departments that receive the Department of Education, their education group. You know, who's going to be making those decisions, and how are those priorities going to be identified?
Right.
And the second part is, as I said, will the state be mandated to pick up what the federal share was, and now they'll have to do it? Those are questions to me. I don't know.
Yeah. We know this. We know that the SNAP benefits, the federal government was paying 50% and the state was covering 50%. We now know that that's being shifted and the feds will cover 25%. So if the state were to say, now we'll pick up all 70, I doubt that's going to happen.
Well, that's why I'm saying, is it going to be left up to the state to say that, you know, is the state, are you going to do it? Or are you going to put your own rules and regs in place and, you know, develop a different criteria? I don't know. That's the unknown that's out there. I mean, it's great to say we're going to send the money back to the state, but we're not all on the same page as to how to expend those, and if we're going to continue to fund those. Will those continue to be a priority, or will we say, well, if the feds aren't going to fund it, we're not going to fund it?
Right.
That sounds like a lot to decide in one legislative session.
It is. We know that the Appropriations Committee is meeting Wednesday morning. They start at 9 a.m. And BFM is going to present what they believe are some of the impacts coming in from this new legislation. Mm-hmm. And I think that things are kind of fluid right now.
What is zero-based budgeting?
Zero-based budgeting means that you budget for every expense you think you're going to have, actual expense. So I'll use the example. So all your paper, pencil supplies, you're going to have to exact numbers of how many you're going to need. In your programming, how many people enrolled are you going to have in there? How many people do you think are going to leave state government and retire, and how are you going to cover those costs? So that if in a program there's only, you budget for supplies, and I'll just be simplistic, I'll say you budget $30,000 for supplies, all right? And if you have more people in the program and you have more supplies and you don't have $30,000, you have actually $40,000 of expenses, you're short $10,000. Well, if I'm short, then I'm going to have to look at the other departments around there, the other programs within that department. And is anybody long? Did they not have as many eligibles, or can I transfer those dollars so I can fill this bucket? So now it will be, if a department becomes short, there isn't a replacement unless another program is not seeing the same level. And you really don't know that till the end of the year. But you're budgeting for what you believe is your actual cost to run your program.
How do retirements work? People coming and going, people quitting and getting another job, or people retiring?
When we budget for employees in state government historically, and that's how it's been when I left, this is the way I know when I left, is that let's say you have five positions, very simplistic. So we fund those five positions, and that means what their current salary is, what their benefits would be, and what we pay for pensions. So I've got five positions. All right. Then the number one position person decides he's going to retire. Okay. So that person comes out, but we don't have any dollars to pay for that because we're just paying for their supplies and whatever. But in that budget, I've got four other people and I've got an open position. So what I can do is I can take from that open position because there's dollars allocated to pay for that open position. And if I owe that person, I don't know, $15,000 based on their departure, based of everything they've accumulated, I take $15,000 from that position. That means in that position now, I don't have enough money for a full-time person. And I need a full-time person, but I don't have the money to do it. So I guess I'll have to go without. So
what happens when you lay people off? If you lay off, 20% of your staff.
If you lay off your staff, you'd have to pay out whatever they're due.
Mm-hmm. Which is what? Vacation time?
Yeah. It would be paid time. So it could be sick leave. It could be vacation leave that they get.
How much of your sick leave do you get?
You would get 100%. I mean, so assume that you get X amount.
We don't know about that. We're going to
have to check that. I don't know.
We should check that. You get X amount of days per year. You can accumulate sick days over time.
Right.
And I believe in state government that you have to pay out what you've accumulated for. We call it paid time off.
Right.
So if 20 people left, and let's say you had, 30 people in the department.
Sure.
Yeah.
Those 20 people that leave, you wouldn't have enough to pay out for them because you didn't plan for that. That was not, but you have to pay it out. So I don't know where you would get the dollars to pay that out. You'd have to look someplace else in that agency, in that program, if some program had some dollars left over to get those dollars to do that. But we don't plan in the budgeting process up to 24 when I was last there, we did not plan benefits or anything. You just hoped that there were open positions. They sort of budgeted that, they'd budget for a full complement, but agencies did not always get a full complement. You always have some turnover going on. Mm-hmm. So that's how you sort of save that agency, that they could borrow from that open position to pay those benefits because they had it unexpected. Now, in this case, if they decide to make, they'll have to plan for that, thinking that they're all going to leave or
it's not attrition. It's
not attrition that they'll have to figure out if it would be in this budget year, this new fiscal year.
Yeah.
They'd have to be looking, you know. But I think they'd be okay this year because it'll be in the next budget if they have zero-based budgeting, which is probably looking at 26. But that's spec on my part. I don't know.
The thing is that we looked at, or we would have, when we would get budget hearings, we would call them in, and one of the things that we looked at was, what are your attrition rates overall? Mm-hmm. And how many people, where are they falling in terms of close to retirement age? We were assuming retirement age at 65, I think. So they would come in and tell us. And there were departments who were skewing far towards retirement and others that would, it just depends. But
what the ideology is that the legislature does not want to fund for those replacements. If you work for a private company, they're planning that out because they know that they have to do it. But with state government, there was reluctance because it was taxpayer dollars we were talking about. And if you were planning that out, you weren't spending them. Maybe they didn't retire or they didn't attrition out or whatever, and then you'd have an accumulation. And that was a concern for that. So there was never any interest at that point in time to plan for any retirements. But you plan for them in the sense that you knew that they were coming down the road.
Right.
And so, but, as the secretary of that department responsible for that budget, they'd be looking at all areas to say, where can I pick from if, unfortunately, I had more retirees than I had planned for?
Exactly.
Okay.
And we want to make sure that people understand, yes, state employees do get a pension after they retire, but that pension is paid out of that pension fund and not out of that department fund.
Right.
So let's make that distinction right now. That's important to know.
But you are paying for vacation time.
Right.
Or some kind of paid time off, although we don't have those numbers in front of us right now for what exactly that would be.
Yes.
Okay. So this is going to be, we're way ahead of next legislative session. But if you're a quote-unquote citizen legislator, you got a lot on your plate right now to try to figure out before next January. That would be a very difficult job to be
Well, not only for them, but it's also for BFM because they're dealing with this every day, as Linda had said. You know, they're getting new information as to what's available, what's not going to be available, and then the time frame, how do you get that turned around? Working on budgets, I mean, the budget for fiscal year 26, that will have to be shaped up by the end of October, early part of November, as to what the governor is going to be proposing. And you got to see what's coming down. So, yes, this time frame and not understanding, not knowing what the rules of engagement are, it's going to be very challenging.
I think so. The BFM people right now, they just closed the books on 25.
Yeah.
We've kicked off fiscal year 26 as of July 1. And as Senator Hunhoff said, they are now starting to plan for 2027. So those budgets are being designed as we speak. But how do you design a budget when you're not quite sure what the federal rules are going to be? Because it isn't going to look like last year, or even certainly not the year before that. And last year was lean year. I think it's a very challenging environment that not only state, I mean, all the agencies are in, and even nonprofits, because nonprofits do come to us, state government, asking for additional monies.
Yes.
I think that this is going to be, and I think they said that last year, you know, when things were occurring, you know, there's going to be changes down the road, and how do we prepare? Because South Dakota really did get dependent upon federal funds. When the COVID dollars and the ARPA dollars came, those are going to be gone now. And you hear that, unfortunately, in county governments, they're saying, well, there's no more COVID, there's no more ARPA dollars. What are we going to do? And then with that bill that went through for what, property tax and freezing that for a period of time, you know, that's all happening. And that's all you're hearing about, how counties are struggling right now. Mm-hmm. How are they going to operate? I mean, I'm listening to Yankton County, and they're looking at reductions, and, you know, they're doing the best that they can. And so, you know, it's not just state government, because it trickles down, because counties believe we mandate everything, that half their 3/4 of their budgets are mandated by the state government, yet we don't financially support them or give them any kind of opportunity to generate their own revenue.
That's true.
So they're sort of stuck. Mm-hmm. And what do we do? So it's a trickle-down effect all the way as to what these people that are going to be sitting in our legislature this year are going to be facing, and how they're going to process the process to make the right decisions for the taxpayer dollars to achieve those priorities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's leave it there. Jean Hunhoff, Linda Duba, thank you so much for the education. It's what public broadcasting does, that
You're
education.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.